I guess it's find where you can extract the most value from that person, suck them dry as fast as you can.
In a world where only the strong survive, there comes a time when the only way to settle the score is a one-on-one battle to the finish. Two entrepreneurs enter, but only one of them leaves. It's the Entrepreneur Showdown with Joe Cassandra and Dan Franks. Now, on to the showdown.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Showdown. My name is Joe Cassandra. Across from me on his own mic, that is Dan Franks. Today, we are talking about tips from successful founders for launching startups. You're not going to want to miss that. And then we're going to go into the importance of finishing what you are doing. And then to do that, we're going to bring on serial entrepreneur Ryan Ferrier, who sold three startups to large companies.
We got some good startup related content today. And if you like what you hear today, once the show's over, do us a favor. Visit the iTunes store. If you haven't already, click the subscribe button. Leave us a 5-star review. We try really hard to produce some great content for you guys. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you want to hear, and we'll make sure to take care of you guys. And for the show notes on this episode and a little more content, check out our website, entrepreneurshowdown.com. Now, on to round one.
Round one.
Round one of the Entrepreneur Showdown, getting off to a hot start here. And today we're going to talk about some tips that Joe and I have compiled off the internet from successful startup founders about just what they think is important to have a successful startup, what their one tip would be. And we've compiled these off the internet, and we'll kind of link to the sources in the show notes. But just to get right started, the first successful entrepreneur tip that we picked up was come up with unique ideas. Easier said than done, right? Come up with unique ideas. I mean, almost any entrepreneur you talk to will tell you no idea is unique. Any idea you've come up with, somebody somewhere has come up with that idea in the past, right? So there's got to be some kind of secret to taking any idea that other people maybe have tried and not made it work to making it different. So I think while this is from John Meyer at Lemonly, he says come up with something, you know, with a unique idea. And like I said, I think that's easier said than done to just say, come up with something unique. What do you think about this? I mean, all the most successful companies aren't unique. Facebook wasn't the first of its kind.
So are you saying that people shouldn't go out of their way to try to find a unique take on a certain idea? Yes. I guess ideas in general have already been thought of. But a specific take like Redbox, for example, that was a specific take on the movie industry, how people should rent movies. That was a unique idea. The idea of renting movies in general is not a unique idea. The idea of going like a vending machine and renting from like a vending machine type thing was a unique idea. So you saying they shouldn't try and find that unique idea within an already founded idea?
No, and I think the basic idea of coming up with something unique, that is important. You have to do something to differentiate yourself. But that doesn't necessarily have to be your idea. Your idea doesn't have to be unique. If you have an idea that's the same that someone else came up with, but you have a unique way of distributing it or a unique way of marketing it, and that's what sets you apart, I think the bigger picture tip that I would say in this same realm would be just be unique as opposed to a unique idea. So like, for instance, you gave the Redbox example. I can guarantee you, because I've looked into various franchises, there were franchises doing what Redbox is doing now on their own. You just haven't heard of them anymore because they've all been taken over by Redbox. So while Redbox wasn't the first person to do it, or the first group to do this rent a DVD in a box kind of thing, they did something better, whether it was a marketing, whether it was their strategic partnerships, something they did was better. So they were unique to a non-unique idea.
Well, I'm not even for finding, because ideas are a dime a dozen. So people spend their time saying that they're the idea person and everyone else should do all the work. They'll come up with the ideas, which is garbage. The way to find an idea, and it doesn't have to be a unique idea, is just find where there's a need somewhere. Find where people have said, this really sucks, or this is terrible, or I don't enjoy this, and there's your idea. It doesn't even have to be sexy, but that's all we ever focus on is the sexy part. And when you have that already, I guess, founded idea that there's a need, it kind of takes away all that spending money on testing and everything. You don't have to test this whole new brand idea because you already found the need for it. So you don't have to spend any more time on that. But the idea of finding a unique idea is kind of like entrepreneurism in general right now. It's just like the sexy thing. And if you type in how to find a great idea in Google, you'll see ads for getting business loans and everything in the sidebar.
I bet there's some ebooks in there you might be able to access.
I'm sure there are, but I guess finding that unique idea, like you said, most people have already thought about it. So it's more about who's got, not the idea, but who's got the drive to then start executing on that idea. So I think the come up with a unique idea is not a good tip. I think it's a terrible tip.
Do you like my tip? I'll go ahead and throw my non-successful startup in that. Just be unique in general. Like, not to say your idea has to be unique or your marketing has to be unique or any of these one elements has to be unique, but something about you and what you do has to be unique. There has to be something. It doesn't necessarily have to be the idea that's unique, like John talked about
Well, being unique in general, okay, every person in the world is unique, so it's hard to argue that side. If you have a business that's more useful to people, that maybe they're not getting the big press, maybe they don't have the sexy buyouts, but they're useful to people, that's more unique than saying, oh, we need to put a unique spin on our website or put a unique spin on whatever, like our dollarshaveclub.com commercial. Like, we're trying to do a spin off of that. No, it's who's got the drive to execute on that idea, who's found the need, and who's the more useful.
I can buy that.
We'll go on to another tip, which I guess we're kind of tooting our own horns here because we're already doing this right now. So we're not going to stay on it too long because we both agree on it. But it's interview people who have been there or interview people who have done what you want to do and you've learned from them. And we're doing that right now. So, I mean, and we're not going to sit around tooting our own horns, but we get free consulting from millionaires. We get to build an audience at the same time. So we're building influence in ourselves while we're getting this free consulting. And then the most important is while you listen to all these people, all these influencers, you get to learn to see how they think, like how they formulate ideas. While you're just talking to someone, you get to see how they're formulating what you're asking them about to form ideas on what they're giving to you. Because everyone has that unique spin on how to express their ideas. And if you notice, the people who are influencers are the ones who can articulate and give those ideas better than other people.
Yeah, and I think anybody in our niche, anybody who's listening to this podcast, has some sort of interest in startup business or entrepreneurship. And I think they're really doing themselves a disservice if they don't find a way to get in contact and get into communication with some of these influential people and some of these success stories.
Do you think they need to start a podcast like we have, or can they just go and try and reach out to them by email?
No, not necessarily. I think we started from nothing. We had, 20 guests secured before we ever broadcast our first episode of the podcast. But the fact that we reached out to people, we kind of painted the picture of what we were looking to do. They could tell that we were motivated. They could tell that we had a somewhat unique idea. Whatever it was, we were able to communicate to these people that, hey, we're trying to do something. We could really appreciate your help. In our instance, it was asking them for interviews and discussions. But I think if we were just, someone trying to start a business in general, I think we have this such a great community of people that are willing to help each other. Now, some of them have ulterior motives because they're going to have some coaching program that they're maybe going to introduce these people to. But I think in general, our community is a great community for fostering these budding entrepreneurs and helping out for free in any way they can.
So you just gave... You just said, no, they don't have to start a podcast, but then you just said that this community is actually what makes it great because...
And I'm not talking about the podcasting community. I'm talking about the community of these people that we've interviewed or we've reached out to, these bloggers. I mean, think about it. In the old school days with paper newspapers, you didn't have the opportunity to have one-on-one discussions with these writers. You couldn't go down to the newspaper factory. I mean, I guess you could, but you couldn't go down to these places and talk with the writers. But now we're in a world of blogs where if someone puts up a long blog post or even an article and there's interaction and you can comment, you can ask a question on those comments, and there's a very good chance that even this multimillionaire who's writing this blog is going to respond to you and answer any question you ask. That's something that couldn't be done years ago, and there's still industries that can't be done in, but this entrepreneurial community, it seems like the vast majority of people are very willing to help out. So I think this whole tip from Brett Farmelow at Digital Marketing Agency, I think it's great. He says interview people before you get started, or interview people that have started before you. And he uses the term interview, but I even think just the term interact with these people.
But the people that we've already had on, some of the millionaires, do you think if we didn't have a show that they would agree to come and talk with us for an hour? I don't think so.
And that's where I get into the idea of Brett saying you need to interview them. I would replace that word if I were writing this, interact with them. Get in contact with them.
But interacting isn't the same as having a free hour of consulting.
I agree with that. So we have 100% leveraged this idea that Brett throws out there of interviewing somebody. We have done just that. We've interviewed people that have done things and been places that we're trying to get to. That's a little harder. You ask the question, do you need to have a podcast
or
something like that?
That helps you when you say, hey, I have a podcast. Right when you say that and I want to bring you on, they're automatically going to say more likely to teeter towards your direction than if you just say, I'd like to take you out to coffee and extract every type of value I can.
I agree. The whole take you out to coffee thing, that's overrated, and I think that's probably...
I've used that before, so back off.
Well, I think the success rate on that is kind of low, and honestly, in Dallas, you know, there's very few people that are in this space that are publicly in this space that we could reach out to for that. Everyone's in all across the country. But like I said, if somebody puts out a blog post, entrepreneur X, Y, or Z puts out a blog post that you're interested in, and you have a question that relates to it that could help you with your business, we have the forums now to be able to ask that question there and to get almost an immediate response. That can be super valuable. And all I'm saying is that I agree with this whole idea of reaching out to people, whether it's for an hour-long interview or a 30-second comment response. I think it's good, and I think that anybody who's not leveraging these sources of getting information from these experts is doing themselves a disservice.
I guess we agree on the interview part. We just don't agree on if you should have a podcast. Even if you don't even plan to do anything long-term, I think it gives you that foot in the door, because when people hear interview and a podcast, they automatically assume, it's like if you have this podcast, you're proving that you have authority, that you have influence on other people, and that they're more likely to get on there.
But let me ask you this, because we've seen the exact opposite. Well, there's people we've reached out to that have said, not right now. Either let me see 10 episodes, let me see you guys prove that you're really going to make something out of this. We've had people that said that, while those same people at their blog are answering a series of questions from, you know, one of their readers or listeners. So that goes the exact opposite direction. Maybe these people aren't willing to commit an hour to an interview, so therefore we get nothing. Whereas little Joe Schmo starting his entrepreneur startup is asking questions on a blog, and he is getting value out of these people. So I think it goes both ways.
I guess it's fine where you can extract the most value from that person, suck them dry.
That's right.
As fast as you can.
So we're going to move on here to kind of two competing tips for startups that we found here. And we're going to discuss them at the same time, because they're two almost completely opposite ideas that two separate entrepreneurs give. And it's really two fundamental differences. So the first tip is from Brittany Hodak at ZignPack. And she says, take a corporate job first. But then Nicholas Grimian from free-ebooks.com says, start up now, when in his meaning for now is right out of high school or before you get established. So the whole idea behind the first point of view, take a corporate job first, is you're not going to know how bad it is on the other side of the table until you've been there. So then it'll be even more encouraging to put all your effort towards this startup, because you've seen how bad it would be otherwise. But then Nicholas's point of view is that you have, when you're right out of high school or right out of college or at whatever point you decide to start your startup now, as you get older, you get more responsibilities, whether it's a mortgage, whether it's a wife, whether it's or a husband, or whether it's kids. You're only going to get more responsibilities as you go. So at whatever point you're at right now, start it now. That's what he says.
Brittany was saying with the taking a corporate job, one of the things she also stressed on is figure out how you don't want your company to be run, and then you know this is how your company is going to be run, because it's not going to be like the company that you were coming from. But I think I'm on her side where if you have a corporate job, you understand the business side of it. I guess it depends on what aspect of the job you're in. I think some are more you're more advantaged than others. If you actually see how money comes in, how money goes out, how sales are made, how marketing is done for the company, then you're able to understand just in general how a business is run, how it is profitable. While, I mean, just starting up out of, I mean, and we've talked about this before again, if you're in a situation where you're able to crash and burn really quick and it's not going to end up with you being homeless, then maybe you should take that step. But I think if you're able to have a corporate job first and you have that time, you should learn some of those skills, learn some just business skills in general. Do the best you can at that job. Don't just half-ass it the whole time, but do your best at that job. Learn how it's run, and you're going to be able to transmit those skills into something else.
So what is your opinion on her thought that, and you mentioned it, take the corporate job first to find out how things shouldn't be run? But I think you and I have both somewhat experienced this, that you and I have both had corporate jobs or big business jobs where things were really bad and we didn't like the way they were run. But we've also had kind of opposite experiences where we've been with companies that are really good and it's like, hey, this company is doing things the right way. So I guess the idea behind that is you do see how things should be and how things shouldn't be. But her whole idea is to use this as the impetus of starting your own startup. So what happens if you get with this company that's doing things the right way and that's where you're at now? Then you, I mean, because she's saying, by working for this bad company first, this company that just makes you hate the corporate lifestyle, that's going to be encouragement to leave. But what if you go into the corporate environment and you think that's not so bad?
That's not a good jump-off point to go and try and hate the other side as much as you can and then come to this side. That's not a good way.
Is that not what she's saying?
That is what she's saying, but I'm not agreeing with that part. I'm agreeing with the take at the corporate job part. I'm saying that you want to pick up those assets, your soft assets, while you're at a corporate job and you're actually building up your hard assets in cash and such, not to go there and try and let's find a way to hate corporate America as much as possible so that you'll be more driven to succeed in the entrepreneurial world. I think it's a terrible way to think about it.
But you and I have had this talk before where you've had quite a few poor experiences with different corporations and different large companies. So
agreed.
You're just saying that was your luck. I'm saying
I had those experiences and that helped me to start looking in other areas like the online world, but that it wasn't a point. It was a good turning point to help me to lead me to where I am right now, but it wasn't, oh, go take the job so you can learn exactly what not to do with the business. That's not what I was doing because I didn't even know anything about entrepreneurship when I was at that job. It was more, that was a way that opened up another door to say, there has to be something else that I could be doing better. There has to be somewhere where I could be improving because I'm not improving here. I don't enjoy being here.
So you're saying this is almost like that Penelope Trunk piece we covered where by accident you learn a lesson that happens to help you. So while Brittany almost seems like you should take this corporate job to learn the negatives about corporate America.
No, that's stupid.
You're saying you disagree with that. But if you happen to go into corporate America and it happens to give you that same end result, then it's lucky, but you shouldn't seek it out. You should just, if it happens, it happens.
What's the point? If you already know you're going to go along that path and the only reason you're going to get a corporate job is to figure out that you hate it, I don't think that's the way to go. If you're going to go learn something first.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not a huge fan of this point, but we did pick it out just because it's quite a hot topic. And Brittany, she saw it as training on someone else's dime, which I guess I can see that point of view. But, you know, it's also, you've brought up the point in the past that that's 5 years wasted. That could have been, you know, real world training for your startup.
If you look at the job and you do the best you can at the job and you're learning those skills at that job, you're learning all you can about the business, it's not 5 years wasted. It's if you take 5 years just to see, well, this is how I don't want my company to run, I don't think that's a good use of your time. I think it is good to figure out what works and you're in a position where you're not the boss, you're on the bottom of the totem pole and you realize this is how it works. This is how I don't want the bottom of the totem pole in my business to be like. I want them to feel loved, feel like they can enjoy this position. That's a good experience. I wouldn't go into corporate America just to do that test. I think that's, you could easily just interview people and get those same ideas.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're kind of on the same page as far as maybe some of her ideas are right, but not her tactic for being a successful startup. So we're getting a little long in the tooth here, but let's go to this last one that we picked out, which is from Mitch Gordon at Go Overseas. I don't know if you've been to Go Overseas before, but it's a pretty interesting website. But his key point was to be transparent. So many people in the startup space think they have this great idea that they have to protect from everybody else, that they don't want to share their ideas because they think someone's going to steal their idea. Someone's going to take their idea and run and make the millions that they were going to make. Mitch says, don't worry about that. He says the value you'll get of bouncing your ideas off other people that might have more experience or be better than you, that value is going to far exceed any chance of your ideas getting stolen.
Well, what do you think about that? Do you think people should share as much as possible, or should they kind of keep stuff to themselves?
I think it's a tightrope. I think there is a balance that you have to find, and everyone has to find their comfort level within themselves. I mean, look, when we had our idea for this podcast, we were very open with other people and other podcasters, more specifically with, hey, this is what our idea for this podcast is. And we were taking feedback. We heard mostly positive, and we had some critiques of it that helped us form it. So I think that we would not have gotten those small critiques back and maybe tweaked things the way we have if we didn't have that feedback. Not saying that this was this million-dollar idea that we were afraid of people taking and making millions with, but that's the thing I can most recently equate it to, is that we were able to get feedback that we wouldn't have otherwise.
But what about from a marketing standpoint, where you're in this what they call stealth mode and you're trying to build up excitement for something, and so you don't want to release everything all at once? You want to release in little bitty chunks, and you want to build up a following first before you make that big kaboom. That actually could work to your advantage, because you're building up that, I guess, that following before you even have anything.
Yeah, but I think what Mitch is talking about is being transparent with startups. He's talking about, you know, from the ground floor when you're working to get this startup off the ground. I think that's more what he's talking about, is just be transparent with your ideas, not necessarily techniques or tactics that you're going to use once you get things going. I think it's just more talking about when you have these ideas that are nothing more than ideas in your head. Don't, you know, you're not going to be stupid about it and go, you know, on the street corner and scream out this idea, but you're going to be tactful about picking out who you want to bounce these ideas off of and kind of leverage them to get advice from others who probably are better, you know, better able to help you than you are able to help yourself.
I mean, it's definitely, especially once a company's up and going, you hear that.
What do you think? You asked me what I think. What do you think about being transparent? Should you be open about this because of the benefits of hearing the feedback?
I am more on, once you've built up a following and once you build up a huge business, like say a McDonald's or whatever, and they're revealing all their inner and outers and revealing what's in their McDonald's sauce and whatnot, I think that's a good thing. I think that can only help them. But I think in the beginning, you should have a little bit of secrecy. You should keep some stuff to yourself. You don't want to just release to anyone, especially if people that you don't know as well. You're saying, oh, go be tactful with who you share your ideas with, but you sometimes don't want to give all your, put all your apples in one basket, put all your eggs in one basket. You want to keep some of it for yourself, because that's yours. That's your possession that you have.
Well, I think this, and I, like I said, I know we're running long here, but I think this has to be said. We actually, you and I together, the same day we were recording, we saw this Marcus Sheridan TEDx talk where he talked about the same example that you were giving with the McDonald's, and that McDonald's of Canada put on their website kind of a question and answer open forum, ask us anything and we'll tell you anything. And they're really trying to change their image. They're not trying to hide how unhealthy their food is. They're not trying to hide what's in their food. They're trying to be transparent and open, and this is the method they're taking to building this customer loyalty. And someone even asked them, this is what Marcus was saying in his talk, someone asked McDonald's, what is the secret sauce in the Big Mac? And they came up and said, not only are we going to tell you what the secret sauce is, but we're going to show you a video of how the secret sauce is made. So I think this is the ultimate transparency, and this is kind of straying away from the startup, but this is more going towards the idea of transparency. Think about the customer loyalty they're building and the customer trust they're building that they wouldn't have had before had they not been transparent.
But what about that aura, that mystery that you want to have in your company, that like Apple, they only let certain people see like their new products because they don't want all the employees to see it, because they're building up that mystery, that aura. And then you don't even know what's going to be in the next iPhone 50 until they release it, because they built up that mystery instead of Like some people, they'll tell, they'll release everything before they've even let it out to the market because they want to be transparent and share as much as possible.
Well, that's like the new Xbox. Everyone knows what's going to be on the new Xbox, but it hasn't been released yet, right?
Yeah.
But you're saying that then the Apple's the exact opposite. They have their big announcement, and then a few days later, kind of, it's available to the market. So those are two completely different strategies, but they're obviously working for both.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying they should be lying or anything like that, because we've already seen what happens with, like, Enron and stuff like that. But I think a little bit of mystery always helps. Everyone should have a little mystery. Everyone shouldn't just leave everything out on the table. I don't think that always is the best strategy to do it.
Well, we'll leave the rest of this talk to mystery as well, because we're going to end round one right here. On to round two.
Round two.
It is now time for round two of the Entrepreneur Showdown. We're going to be looking at Ryan Ferrier today, and he has an article, The Lost Art of Finishing, where it's actually a really interesting story. It's great storytelling. He goes through the process when they were selling one of his startups to Zynga called Serious Business, and how basically it came down to the wire in selling and getting like the deal done. And it was him as the COO that had to just keep going to all these different people, just basically willing it to get completed. And we're going to have Ryan on in just a little bit to talk about that, talk about his new program called 60 Day MBA, and then also talk about some of the startups he sold. But first, we're looking at this article. You just kind of, you put yourself in the place of him while he's trying to run about trying to sell this startup and get to that finish line. And you always start to think about yourself, like, would I have that kind of determination? What do I have that kind of finishing drive? And he talks about that, how to be a finisher at work. And you can see those points. We're going to link up the article below. But you always wonder, would you be able to, I guess, like, will something to happen? Do you have that finishing attitude to get what you need done, whether you're at work or whether you're starting up a company?
Yeah, and he does a good job at painting this picture about what he actually went through to get this company sold. The day the company was supposed to, I guess, close with the state and all everything, the merger was supposed to be approved. There was a huge snowstorm that was on its way to the city. I believe they're in Delaware, and the state of Delaware was where it was the company was formed. And they needed somebody from the state House of Representatives to approve this merger. And everybody had already taken off for the day in anticipation for the storm. But he called every single representative's office until he found one who was still at the office and somehow convinced her to stay until 5 p.m.
Yeah, 5.
To sign this thing. And at 4:59, he actually got it signed. And you hear stories all the time of something like this coming up, stopping the merger at that time or stopping the sale at that time. And then because of that, for whatever reason, one thing leads to another and the sale ends up not going through at all. So who knows if he hadn't gone to all these lengths to do this, to see it, see the finish to the end, who knows if that actually would have ever taken place. There's no knowing, but you hear stories like that all the time.
Yeah, I think it comes down to how much do you, I'm just going to say love, how much do you love your product, your business, whatever work you're doing, whether you're still out in the workforce or not, how much do you love it that you're willing to keep going that extra mile? And I doubt it was even motivated by any type of monetary compensation. I'm sure it was just he just had so much pride, and I'm sure he put so much sweat equity into this company that he wanted the best outcome for it, and he was willing to do anything for it. And especially at some place where maybe you aren't the founder of the company, how much are you invested into that company that you're willing to put all that blood, sweat, and tears to help that company succeed as well?
Yeah, and I think something like this, it really shows that seeing something to the finish is the ultimate validation. Whether, like you said, whether you are one of the co-founders like Ryan was in this situation, or whether you're just an employee or a partner or someone involved that really is putting those blood, sweat, and tears towards seeing something from start to finish, it's the ultimate validation. Like you said, maybe at some point you're not even driven by the money. The money's nice and it's there and you know it's there. But the fact that you have something in this company that probably for years people were patting you on the back saying, yeah, this is a great product, you guys are doing some great things. But the fact that there's somebody willing to put this amount of money, you know, money where their mouth is the ultimate validation that, yes, what I've done, what I've built, what I've contributed to is something that's worth a lot to some people. And the fact that you know, you've got these people now that are willing to put all this money towards it. You want to see it through to the finish, and you want to, you know, be validated completely. And I think that's huge. I mean, we can speak for that from the podcast. We've got this product, and there's a lot of people that are telling us they like the concept. They like where we're going with this. They want to see it continue to grow. But at the end of the day, you know, what's it going to be to us if nobody downloads it and we get no views and no reviews? You know, it's great to have people tell you it's good,
yeah.
But the kind of the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah, it's I guess we've talked a lot about in the past couple episodes how important it is to start off right and to find the right idea and start testing. But he's actually going to the other side of the fence where he's saying, hey, you actually need to have that will to get across the finish line. And he sold 3 startups, and we'll talk to him about that as well. So he knows how to get to that point of, hey, I need to get this done. And he's mentions that he's like the business aspect of it. He's the business side of it, and maybe not as much the tech side of it. So he has to handle all the numbers, all the lawyers and everything like that. And you can only guess that dealing with all those different personalities is a huge pain that he has to handle. But he's already shown that, hey, he has that finishing drive. And we're going to talk to him about that on what is that motivation to keep going to get to that finish line. Is part of it monetary? Is part of it just intrinsic motivation? You have so much pride in this product, or maybe you're trying to prove something to someone else. We're going to get to dig in with him about that and talk about how you could be a finisher, whether you're at work as an employee. What can you do to get ahead? Because people go to the finisher. It's like the closer in baseball. Everyone knows, okay, eighth inning or so, we got to go to our go-to guy to close it out. And you want to be that person. People forget about the people in the beginning of the inning, the beginning of the game, who hit that first inning home run. But everyone remembers the guy who hit that ninth inning home run to win the game. So we're going to talk to him about that and get his insight on how you can be a finisher wherever you are in the workforce.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting in Ryan's case. He's somebody who's done it multiple times. You hear all these stories of people who have the startup business. They sell it for millions, and then they kind of fade off, and they go through a series of things that don't work anymore. Then they blow all that money on all these other startups.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they turn into a angel investor and then lose all their money investing in all these other things that don't work out. So I think it's interesting that he's somebody who's done it, rinsed, repeat. He's done it multiple times. So he kind of can give us, I think, a point of view that maybe not others can, because I'm sure after his first company sold, he learned something, maybe finished a little different the next time. Maybe after this situation where it came down to the wire, maybe he treated the closing of the sale a little differently because of the lesson he learned. So I think it'll be interesting to learn from him how he's changed his business philosophies as far as finishing.
Yeah, and I'm curious if it gets like easier, like when you get to the third one, is it a lot easier than when the first one, because you already kind of know like what's going to happen or who's going to try and mess around with you and try to negotiate you the wrong way. So it'll be interesting to talk to him about that. So we're not going to waste any more time. We're really excited about this. We're going to bring in Ryan Ferrier to talk about the 60-day NBA, how to be a finisher at work, and all the different startups he's done.
It's time for the main event.
That's right. It is time for the main event, and we are bringing on Ryan Ferrier. Ryan Ferrier is a serial entrepreneur. He started and sold 3 companies to Microsoft and Zynga, Serious Business, Crowdflower, and PowerSet. He knows how to get deals done. Now he's taken his sweat equity and turned it into a new course called the 60-Day MBA that you can get involved in right away. You can find him at ryanferrier.com, and you'll find him right here now on the Entrepreneur Showdown. Ryan, how you doing? Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm really glad to be here.
Definitely. So we touched on, in round 2, we talked about your lost art of finishing, and you told in that story when you were selling, I believe it was PowerSet to Zynga, and you were talking about having to scramble. Is it not PowerSet? Which one was it?
So the company that we sold to Zynga was Serious Business.
Which was
a social gaming company. But keep going. I might clarify some of this stuff. But
gotcha.
Going, yeah.
And you were talking about how you had to scramble everywhere trying to get the deal done, and some people had gone home, but you were there till getting the deal done at 4:59.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through that day and what was going through your mind the whole time?
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. Let me walk you through. Let me do a little clarification only because just because I want to. PowerSet was a business. It was a search engine that I was an early employee of and was, you know, it wasn't really me that got that deal done, although that company was acquired by Microsoft and I was like instrumental in building the company. Serious Business was indeed my company that we sold to Zynga, and Crowdflower is another company that helped get off the ground. They're still alive and ticking, so that company's still out there. Just so people know, those are some of my businesses. As far as Serious Business, us getting the deal done with Zynga, which is Zynga acquired us, I believe, in 2010. It was a crazy process, and you want me to describe the day of the deal,
Sure. Got done? Because what you focus on here, you're talking about finishing, and we're trying to figure out like what kept you going to get to that finish line.
Okay, yeah, well, a lot of things, you know, one of them being money. So the way I guess for some context, the way that an acquisition happens is. Usually, it's a longer, slower, more painful process than people think. People think of it as this glamorous thing where Microsoft or Zynga or whoever the acquirer is comes in and gives you, your company, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, and then they read it on TechCrunch and it sounds like, wow, this is like, you know, this is just like the coolest thing in the world. And it is really cool, but actually getting there is kind of a brutal process. We at Serious Business, we were a successful gaming company, you know, doing many millions of dollars a year in revenue with a very successful Facebook application. Actually, we had a suite of them that all did really well. And we began getting kind of interest from a bunch of different kind of bigger suitors, like people, publicly traded companies, and Zynga, which was kind of on a huge growth rate. Now they are a publicly traded company. But people wanted to basically add our games and our engineers into their team. And so the early stages are really exciting because, you know, once these guys start talking to you, it's like you feel like you're kind of like the you know, the pretty girl in the bar or whatever, right?
yeah.
So that's really, really cool. And then it gets really exciting when somebody when they begin talking terms, right? And we had multiple people talking terms, and so we were able to kind of talk just – general terms with some of these different businesses, and that, you know, got even more exciting. And then finally Zynga came in and said like, hey, we're gonna make you a really, really strong offer because we don't want other companies, you know, like an Ubisoft, which is a big game company, or Real Networks, which is a smaller game company, to you know, basically get a foothold in this industry. We want to own this industry. So they came in with a really strong offer. But when you, what happens is you talk terms and then you sign basically, what's called an LOI, which is a letter of intent. It says that, you know, these two companies intend on merging together.
Mm-hmm.
But that just, you know, sketches out the basic terms. And then usually you go into a period where there's a non-compete where you can only talk to that company that you've signed an LOI with. And that's when it's kind of this rude awakening. You realize this process is far, far from done. And this is when a lot of deals fall apart. And so what happens is you sign this LOI, and then there's this due diligence period where the acquiring company, now, before you're the pretty girl at the bar and you've got lots of people hitting on you, now you're exclusive and you've got a bigger company who is, you know, the only company talking to you, and they have a lot of leverage because you've agreed not to talk to anybody else, right? And so then the process becomes a lot less fun because then they start doing due diligence on your company, asking for every document you've ever signed, picking every little, you know, fault they could find with your business. You know, it's kind of like a grand inquisition where they ask you all these questions to prove, like, you really are who you say you are. Are you really this, you know, are you really the most beautiful girl at the bar, right?
Yeah.
And so then it gets exhausting, and a lot of times what happens is people get excited about the general terms in the LOI, and then they get into the due diligence phase, and everything falls apart because the larger company has a lot more leverage now. They, you know, try to drive the price of the deal down, and as well they try to drag it out because it's, you know, the longer your company is in this limbo phase where you're your own entity, but you're thinking about merging with this other entity, the more momentum, you know, or more energy that's given to that, you know, the more you feel like, all right, I just want to get this deal done. So if the acquiring company can stretch that out, they can usually negotiate better terms and kind of just like wear you down. Because they have a whole, you know, they have a whole team that does nothing but mergers and acquisitions. And, you know, my company had me and the CEO and you know, our CTO was involved too. But like it was really mainly, day to day. It was just me. So it's me and our lawyers, trying to make this transaction happen. And they have, you know, a team of 20 plus people. And so, what happens is a lot of deals fall through, or a lot of deals, the terms aren't as cool as people thought they once were. And by the end of the process, even if you get the deal done, and even this happened in our case, it ended up being a great deal. And Zynga ended up IPOing after the deal, which made it an even sweeter deal for, people who had Zynga stock. But by the end, you're just kind of like, man, you feel like you almost got like a divorce or something, because you had this business and it's no longer yours and it was your baby, and you just put a price tag on it, and now this other business owns it. And so, it's kind of an exhausting, I mean, in some ways, like honestly, kind of like a brutal process. And then you come out the other side, and if you can successfully make it through, it's like definitely worth it. Obviously, like both just like financially, career wise, being able to have like started, run, and then exited or sold, a company is a huge achievement. So, it's just a lot less sexy. It's a lot more like running a marathon. It's a lot less like Usain Bolt, you know, blazing by in a 100-meter dash.
So then if it is all this, because all we see on the newspapers is that big event of you shaking hands and getting all that financial stuff, but you just talked about the whole process, and that was great. I've never heard the behind the scenes of an acquisition. So what type of people can do this type of stuff? Who do you think are the type of entrepreneurs that can get to that finish line and get those deals done like you did three times?
Interesting. I think it really is more about a type of person than a skill set. And, you know, in my newest kind of venture, which is called 60 Day MBA, we talk a lot about this. People think that to do an acquisition or to run a successful business, you need to have some sort of high level business training, right? And it's really just not the case. I've worked with, and frankly, I've had a lot of MBAs work for me at different companies, and some of them are great and some of them are not, but really it's intrinsic qualities as well as like skills that you develop on the ground that are really the most valuable. And when it comes time to make an acquisition happen, it doesn't matter, you know, it's helpful to have people who understand like finance and can do a little bit of analysis on what your share price is going to be in this new scenario. And there's a little bit of complicated math, but it's not anything you can't do in an Excel spreadsheet and with some, you know, basic kind of algebra. But actually getting the deal done, really, it's more about someone who's going to be willing to continue to show up day in and day out until the task is fully 100% complete. Because there's so many I's to dot and so many T's to cross that it's like a stamina test. And so really, the type of entrepreneurs who do well in an acquisition scenario are ones who are not afraid of the dirty work, first of all, right? Are not worried about like, all right, I'm going to have to like get a bunch of papers filed. I'm going to have to, you know, who are not afraid of like continuing to smile even though you're frustrated, you know, when this other party who you want to do a deal with, ultimately you guys are going to be one company, they feel like they're drawing things out or they're, you know, being evasive or whatever. You're persistent, but you don't get, you know, you don't get too hostile, right? Because then the deal breaks down if you know, the sides get too hostile. But then as well, you need like the kind of emotional intelligence on when you need to press on this other side and say like, hey guys, if we don't hurry up and get this done, then we won't, you know, then our LOI will run out, which is your letter of intent, and we won't sign an extension, right? So you need to be able to put your foot down and say like, hey, it either gets done in the next, you know, 15 days or it doesn't. So it's really a mix of somebody who's willing to continue to show up, somebody who's willing to do the dirty work, and then someone with actually a high EQ, really more than IQ in that situation.
Now, Ryan, you talked about there was a number of motivating factors that really pushed you towards this finish line in this particular sale that we're discussing, and one of them you said was money. But was there an element of fear, either in the front and back of your mind, that if this didn't happen on this day, that it might not happen at all?
Yeah, so we definitely, we got to the point, we actually, you know, and I can't like go too deep into the weeds, but, you know, we had a letter of intent. And we actually ended up signing an extension for that, meaning that we extended the time frame. And as those things drag on, it's like, you know, if you're signing like multiple extensions, all of a sudden you kind of feel like, oh, is this never going to happen? You know, are we better just cutting bait and running, or, you know, or is the other party not, you know, excited? And so we had already signed one extension, and we realized, for me, we knew that we were getting very close to getting the deal done. But I also realized that, like, it's like any relationship. Like, if there's a good cadence and momentum, it's going to be successful. And if you start to lose that, if, you know, like, you start to get out of sync, and things drag on, it's just easier for everything to fall apart. And so we actually had, like, kind of, it was kind of a dramatic scenario in that we were at the end of our extended period of the kind of our letter of intent. We had, you know, literally a few days to make the deal get done. And we were getting all the paperwork, getting it all ready to get signed. And the way that it works is we actually had to get the deal, the merger, approved by the Delaware courthouse because, but, you know, our company was incorporated in Delaware. And it just so happened that this is in February and there was this huge snowstorm about to hit the East Coast and our LOI is about to run out. And, it turns out that, you know, we agree that we're going to close the deal. I think it was like on a Thursday, and this is like Wednesday. And then, so I start talking to the Delaware courthouse, you know, getting them ready to approve this immediately so we can get this thing done and it doesn't drag. And they inform me, like, hey, there's a huge snowstorm. We're going to be closing early tomorrow. we've been working on this for 60-plus days. You know, like, this has been my life every day, all day for, you know, for over 2 months. And you guys are going to close early, and then I'm not, you know, we're going to be left and figuring out, do we need to sign another LOI? And I was like, this is not happening. And so I literally, I called our lawyers. I had them work from our office, which was, they were awesome to do that. Most legal teams wouldn't do that. We had to get signatures from, you know, over 60 people who were in some way associated with the company to make sure that this thing happened. So we were getting all these signatures in. All the signatures had to be in that day. And then I was on the phone while they were collecting signatures with the Delaware courthouse, begging them to stay open until, you know, for a full business day. And after talking to two or three people, I actually finally got a lady who was receptive, who said, you know, the truth is the storm isn't here. It, you know, it's starting to snow, but I will stay, you know, until I think it was four. Oh, I'll stay till 4 o'clock East Coast time, which gave us till 7 o'clock. And literally, I mean, this is not an exaggeration. Up at like 6:59, we sent them all of the signed docs. You know, it was like, you know, hundreds of pieces of paper, and got the deal done. And I just like collapsed. 3 days, did nothing but sleep. So yes, fear was a huge motivator, and it really wasn't. I mean, to be honest, at the end, it wasn't all about like, okay, you know, this is all about the money. It was like you started this major. It's like you're climbing Mount Everest, right? Like you want to get to the top. There was a number of motivations, fear being one of them.
So for someone who wants to be this type of finisher, this closer, like as in baseball, if there's someone at work right now and they want to be this finisher, because everyone remembers the finisher more than the person who, like I said in round two, someone who hits a home run in the first inning isn't remembered as someone who's hits a home run in the ninth inning. How, if you're at work right now, how can you be that finisher? Is it just doing what you're told, or is it going out of your way to find other ways to try and, I guess, break things and make something new?
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think different people have different skill sets. I wrote this post, The Lost Art of Finishing, because I think it's really, especially, like, I'm always surrounded by entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs are great at starting stuff, but not as great at finishing stuff. And if you really just look at the people who are the most successful, they tend to, like, if you ask them, what is it that's made you so successful? I read Warren Buffett's biography. It's a freaking long book. It's called Snowball.
Yeah.
It's like 730 pages, but it was really interesting. He was asked, you know, what's the key to your success? And his answer was focus. And they asked Bill Gates the same question, and he said focus. And people like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are incredibly smart, obviously good at starting stuff, but they stay focused on a project until the end, right? And so I think for folks who, you know, say you're in an office environment or running your own thing, I think taking on responsibilities, extra responsibilities that are not yours, I think that's a great way to start and to begin to, like, shine. I like, personally did this in my own career. I started out actually as an administrative assistant in my first gig and just kept taking on more responsibility. You know, I was like, well, you know, I don't know anything about finance, but I'll learn how to do a financial model. And I would go back and show my boss and be like, hey, that's actually pretty good. Maybe we'll give you a little finance, right? And so I'm a big believer in, you know, taking on more than what's asked. But even more important is when, you know, after you get somebody's interest and the boss says, yeah, that's actually cool. Why don't you build, you know, a kind of a working financial model for me to play with, that when he asks for that request or she asks that request, that you actually deliver the final, you know, functional prototype or working model. So many people get people's attention with something new and cool, and they never deliver that final thing. And so if you can really, like, see, not just open up kind of new windows of opportunity, but, like, close them down by walking, you know, by passing through them, then you're really going to separate yourself. And you can't do that with everything, right? And so you need to find, a few things that are your things and, like, just be like a dog on a bone until they're done.
Well, let's move to the 60-day MBA, because I know you're excited about that, and that's a new thing for you. Where did you come to that, hey, you want to start teaching instead of maybe stop creating for a little bit businesses, but you wanted to start helping other people do that themselves?
So the way I made that transition, and, you know, for your listeners, 60-day MBA is basically a 60-day boot camp to help you get your own business off the ground, even if it's a business on the side. And the reason I came to this was I fell into, like, kind of starting businesses. I was really fortunate. Started as an administrative assistant, actually, at that company, PowerSet. And it was a Silicon Valley company. I didn't know anything about business. I was a studio art major in college. I didn't know anything about technology. And, I mean, still to this day, I'm not very good with technology. But I knew people, and I knew how to, like, frankly, work my ass off. And so I really needed that job. Like, I just literally needed the paycheck. And I got in there, and there was one of the founders, the COO of that company, kind of took me under his wing. And I learned business by doing it. And it was just like, it was like every day I was learning something new. And it was just like kind of blowing my mind. And I loved it. Obviously, the company grew. I grew. I ended up directing personnel and business operations, and then, you know, the company was sold to Microsoft for $100 million, which was like this crazy exit. It was really cool, and, you know, I'd been there when we were five people, and then the company was eventually 80 folks. And through that process, I kind of people became to see me as somebody like, oh, this guy knows how to kind of do all the boring operational stuff with that comes with running a business. So two of my friends who worked at PowerSet were starting this social gaming company, Serious Business, and they said, hey, why don't you come on and be our COO? And I was like, awesome, I would love to. You know, they thought that I kind of ran PowerSet, frankly, more than I did, because the current COO of PowerSet gave me so much responsibility and allowed me to be in front of people so much They were like, well, you've already like done, you've apprenticed under this guy. Why don't you just do it for us? And so I really like very quickly jumped into a COO role, which was, had all sorts of other pressures. Now I had a board of directors and people kind of questioning my, both my background and my skill set. And again, I had to learn on the fly, but I was learning business from the inside and kind of the hard way. And it turned out like you didn't need an MBA to run a multi-million dollar business, to run a business that was, you know, venture financed. You didn't need these MBA skills, which I thought were what I needed. What you needed was, the ability to learn really quickly, to pick things up fast. And as well, you needed the ability to kind of be agile, which is like a startup term for, you know, be flexible and be able to, another startup term, iterate quickly. So like, once you test something out, you learn from it, and then you test it out again and do it a little better each time. And so I loved that whole process of learning how to run a business, and it was obviously like really great for me, both career-wise, financially, like all around. It was awesome. But the truth was I didn't really care that much about the products, right? Like I didn't care that, like I'm not a big search engine geek, right? I'm not a social gamer, right? And so I was thinking, what would be a way that I could start a business where I really cared about the end product and as well leverage some of these experiences? And for me, that was teaching, because I'm a communicator and a teacher first. It's just kind of my natural skill set, and I'd learned all these operational skills. And so I was consulting as an interim COO at a number of different startups, and one of them was a company called One Block Off the Grid, which helped people buy solar panels for their house at the best rate. And the CEO of that company, Dave Lorenz, was in the middle of selling that company, and I helped them sell the company. And after that company was sold, we kind of got together, and he was asking me what I was up to, and he was kind of watching me do some of this stuff online, and we kind of hatched a plan. We were like, you know, it'd be really cool. Neither of us has an MBA. Neither of us is actually super technical, so we're not like programming wizards, but both of us has run and sold, you know, multi-million dollar businesses. It'd be really cool to teach just like normal people like us who didn't have the Silicon Valley experience how to start and run their own business. And so we launched the 60-Day MBA, which is a 60-day program to help what we call everyday entrepreneurs launch their own business. So we basically take all the Silicon Valley kind of like insider know-how, and we've packaged it up in a really like simple, practical, step-by-step course that gets people from like a business idea to, you know, making their first thousands of dollars, you know, running their business.
So Ryan, I think this is actually a fantastic idea, and especially for someone like you to be one of the people in charge of this, because as you mentioned before, one of the biggest hurdles that entrepreneurs, or one, I guess I should say one of the biggest skills that entrepreneurs don't seem to possess all the time is the art of finishing. And that, and you've proven in your past and in this article specifically that that's something that you do possess. So that seems like a great kind of convergence of skills, is that maybe these entrepreneurs that you're working with have this great idea, but you're going to stand side by side with them to help them see through the finish. What's the biggest, I guess, skill or the biggest lesson you can teach them to try to make, turn them into finishers just like you are?
Absolutely. So I'll give you the biggest skill in a second, but you're totally 100% right about the finishing. Like our course, the whole kind of magic behind the course is that like we get in the trenches with you, and we will not stop until you're successful. We get people on live Google Hangouts where they're interacting. It's not just like a bunch of downloads where you go to a members area. We have a members area with downloads, but it's we don't just dump content on people and say, all right, cool, this is how you start a business, good luck. We actually like coach you through the process, which is painful in some ways, but it's great accountability. The number one thing that we see with our entrepreneurs, especially in the beginning, is that they're holed up in their apartment or in their house, or maybe they're at a job, but they're trying to start their own thing, but they're trying to get their idea perfect, and they're trying to get their product completely dialed, and they don't, you know, they've been, we have people who've been business planning for over a year and never launched something in the real world. And we get people out there talking to customers in the first week, even if they haven't nailed down their idea. So the biggest hurdle that I think people face is just getting out there. And that's what our course does. We get people out there talking to customers. We give them a step-by-step framework for how to approach your first customers. And so we literally give them the email template to email people, the questions to ask in that first meeting, and then how they can turn what they learned from that first meeting into an offer that they test out. And we have people test out their offer before they've ever built it. So this is like just very, this is like startup Silicon Valley style build a business. Why spend all the effort and energy building out this beautiful product that you think people want without having tested in the real world whether people want it? So we get people in week one talking to customers, in week two figuring out exactly what their offer is, and then in week three, they're out making, making an offer. So people are making money within the first month of starting because they're testing very quickly whether their idea is valid. And if it's not, they take that learning and then they quickly iterate on it. And then they send out version two of their offer to see if people will pay for that.
So Ryan, what it looks like to me is, there's, I guess, the hot thing to do or in the past has been to create these co-work spaces or these incubators where people will be able to work together to develop ideas. Is that kind of what you're creating only digitally by bringing all these classes together, as you call them?
That's interesting. Yeah. It is. What happens is when you have these virtual classes where everybody's on a Google Hangout and it's you and say, 5 to 8 other entrepreneurs, is you start getting inspiration even if they're starting a different business. And actually we thought we were going to segment people by their specific type of business once they kind of knew what they were going to do. But we found that having people in different businesses, there's like this kind of like cross-pollinization of ideas where like people are inspired to keep each other accountable. But as well, they're learning from people doing different stuff, right? And so we have one guy who launched a men's fashion line. He just had this idea. He wanted to sell this pair of travel pants, travel-inspired pants for people to wear while they're traveling. And it had been an idea for over a year. Well, during our course, he sold his first pair of pants and then went on to sell his first kind of like production run. But he paired in a class with a lady who does narrative snapshots for small B2B companies. And what that means is she talks to these small companies, figures out what their business does, and then does like a day in the life snapshot of the end user of these technology companies' businesses. And then she creates an animated story that she puts to video, all around explaining in 3 minutes or less what this company does from the perspective of an end user. So two like very different businesses. They're in the same class and they're asking me for each other's emails and then they're starting to email each other. And now they're learning from one another and keeping each other accountable. So like, yes, that's like absolutely the kind of environment that we're fostering. And a lot of this is we just learned this from doing it. We didn't realize that this type of interaction was going to happen when we first launched it. We just wanted to make sure that we had an environment where we could really hold people accountable, and we know that doing that live as opposed to just giving people downloads and materials for them to consume on their own was going to be more effective. But yeah, we've basically created an incubator without knowing it.
I really like the name 60 Day, because I mean, I guess first it kind of slaps all NBAs in the face, but also did you do some testing with that? Because I know with 60 Day, you're automatically putting in their mind like, hey, I can do this. Was that what you were thinking when you were coming up with that name?
Yeah, we thought about 30 Day NBA, 60 Day NBA, 90 Day NBA, all of these names. It was really more about the appropriateness of the coursework. We were thinking about how long, do we want folks going through this course? We definitely wanted it to be condensed, but we knew that it needed to be sizable enough that they really get something out of it. And the things that we wanted them to get out of it were not only the tools you would need to run a business, but your first customers, right? We wanted people making, their first thousands and thousands of dollars. And it's been, I mean, honestly, people have shocked us at how much money they're actually able to make in that period of time. We were kind of like, all right, get to your first $1,000. That would be an amazing first 60 days. We have folks who are making like, we had a guy who made $1,000 last week, right? And really what that to me speaks to is just the power of how creative people are, especially if they've got a little bit of accountability. They got like kind of a kick in the pants. But we find that it takes at least, you know, having that first month all about landing your first customers, testing your offer, getting paid, is like the right time chunk. And then having the next month to really be able to iterate and have a version two of your offer coming out of those 60 days is what we like to see. And so that's actually how we came up with the name. It was more about the time frame. What we want is people have, we have a method that we have people follow. It's called the 3T method. They talk to a customer. They translate what they've learned into an offer, and then they go test out that offer on their customer. And we like people to be able to go through two cycles of that. One in which they hopefully land a customer, and then once they have a customer, they talk to the current customers, translate their learning, and test it out on a new batch of customers or upsell that current customer. But we want people to go through two of those rotations in a 60-day time frame. So that's how we chose 60 days. It's kind of like the perfect time frame.
That's great. And we'll definitely point them to the site. Where can we find the 60-day MBA?
60daymba.com. It's really self-explanatory. You go to the homepage and you sign up. And what we do is we actually give people a free, right now we give people a free 5-day look-in at the course. So you can see 5 days of course content. You don't get the interaction, obviously. You don't get the live calls. But you see what the course content is. And kind of our bet is, look, our bread and butter is we really know this stuff inside and out. Our bread and butter is that like we feel really confident about being able to teach this. So we're comfortable giving away, you know, some of our course to let you see, you know, for yourself that it's legit. Go over to 60 Day MBA, drop off your email address, and you'll get the first 5 days free.
That's awesome. And if there are people mulling about this, is this course for all people who want to start businesses, or is it only for internet businesses or tech? Is there a certain area you're targeting?
So, to be candid, if you want to start the next Facebook or Twitter, do not take our course. We're not like a Y Combinator, which is it's a incubator that helps launch venture backed businesses. If that's kind of like your play, then we're not for you. But if you've got a passion, right, like maybe it's maybe you want to be a writer but you don't know how to make money from writing, or you're really good, you love social media but you don't know how to make a business out of that, or you've always been thinking about starting your own yoga studio and you don't know how to do that, then we're perfect to help you figure out an offer that will make you money doing work you really care about and allow you to transition from doing that like as a passion or as a hobby to your full-time business, where you can, a lot of our entrepreneurs want to be able to kind of work in different areas and set their own schedule. So if you want to set your own schedule, work in different areas, and have an income that allows you to support that lifestyle, we're absolutely the course for you. But if you want to kind of, raise many millions of dollars and start the next Facebook, probably better off going to a Y Combinator.
Love it. So they're going to give you the first 5 days free. He told you exactly, hey, if you're trying to start the next Facebook, this isn't for you. So he's being out there. Ryan is out and open with us. Ryan, if we want to learn more about just you in general, where can we go?
To be honest, I still think 60 Day MBA is the best place to go. I have a website, ryanjferrier.com. You can stop over there. There's a bunch of articles I've written, but we've already put some of that content on 60daymba.com. And we have a whole about section about me and my co-founder, Dave, that's about to go live on 60daymba.com. So if you're really, really interested in me, if I'm that interested, go over to ryanjferrier.com. Otherwise, you can find out pretty much everything you need to know at 60daymba.com.
Love it. We're going to put all those links right below in the show notes. And, I mean, we could go on talking about this forever, but thank you for your time, Ryan. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you, guys. This is a blast.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown. Thank you so much for joining us this week. Now, to find out more about this show and to see the show notes, check out entrepreneurshowdown.com. Leave us some feedback in the comment section and let us know what you think. And if you like what you've heard, do us a huge favor and head to the iTunes store and leave us a 5-star review. So with that, for my partner Joe Cassandra, I'm Dan Franks. We'll see you next week.